Everybody, welcome to the Atheist Experience. We are live today, Sunday, May 30th, 2021. I'm your host, Matt Delaney. Joining me this week, Dave Warnock. How you doing, Dave?
Hey, Matt. Doing well. Good to be here again.
I know I wasn't supposed to be here. I'm on vacation, but last minute change that was necessary. So I'm flying on my laptop here. And, you know, kudos to the crew for getting the tech set up super quick. And the fact that we planned a little bit for emergencies. We have a number of announcements to get out of the way real quick here. And that is, first of all, welcome to everybody who's watching it live. If you're watching this Atheist Experience episode live on YouTube, thank you very much. We appreciate the support of people watching it live. There's also a good chance for you to participate in the chat, as well as other resources like Discord. But if you're watching it live, there's a donate link down at the bottom. We always like to remind people that there is no part of this that goes to YouTube or Gmail. It comes directly to us, the Atheist Community of Austin, to help promote all the many projects that we do, not just the Atheist Experience. So if you are looking forward to a week without me and we're going to donate, especially because I wasn't going to be here, I'm sorry to throw a wrench in your plans, but you will be donating for all the other shows as well. We all work together. And on that front, in addition to just clicking the donate link, you can also get yourself some Atheist Experience or Atheist Experience Network merchandise by going to bit.ly/AENmerch. Get your coffee cups, t-shirts, and mouse pads, and all kinds of wonderful stuff there. But you can also click join on the actual YouTube channel. Join as a member there for as little as 99 cents a month. Get yourself some fun emotes and be able to participate in the chat as if you were special, because you are. All of you are special. We absolutely are thrilled by the support. You can also go to patreon.com/theatheistexperience and support there as well. But that's not the only thing. It's not just about, oh, how can you contribute to us? It's how can we contribute more to you? So head out to the Facebook groups. There are two new Facebook groups that we like to direct people to as well. There's the Atheist Experience fan page. That's facebook.com/groups/AXPFG. And then there's the private, super secret, awesome fan group. AXPPFG is the link there for that. If you are not familiar with the other programs that the Atheist Experience Network produces, or if you would like them as an audio podcast, there is an AEN podcast channel. That's tiny.cc/AENpodcasts, plural. And there you can find Atheist Experience Talk, Heathen Secular Sexuality, Truth Wanted, all of our various content, including nonprofits, which is now airing on Sundays between Talk Heathen and the Atheist Experience. And all of this is possible, including this last minute change, because of probably the best crew as a part of any show anywhere on the internet. So thank you. Let's get them up there so that you, oh, look at them. Look, there's people doing stuff so that we can all have fun and do a show. How you doing, Dave? It's good to see you.
I'm well, Matt. I wasn't expecting to be able to be here with you, but they found you and you're here, and you're a pro, so you should be able to jump right in, right? And I can't imagine anybody wanting to do a show without you. I mean, I know that people want to call in and argue with you specifically, so I'm sure there are people going, oh, Matt's here.
Well, you know, I'm on vacation, and I can do shows on vacation. I can do shows when I'm at home. Life is just one big chance to do these shows. But I'm thrilled because, you know, I know that you were going to do the show with Jim today, but I'm always looking forward to hanging out with you more. So
I'm
thrilled you're here. We got a ton of calls. You ready to dive in and talk
to
some people?
Let's go. I see that, man. The board is
I got one I want to get out of the way right off the bat. let's see here.
Excuse me.
Should be Zeno on the air. Welcome. How are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Pretty good. You said you were calling in, I guess, for the second or third time now to present evidence for a deistic God, right?
Yeah. I think it's like four or five times. Matt, the thing is, I would love to have the conversation. I just want you to be able to hear what I have to say. It seems like you talk over me a lot, and I would just love to make progress.
Well, it's going to be incredibly difficult to make progress because, see, my understanding of a deistic God is that a deistic God doesn't interact with the physical world at all. And there's no way to detect a deistic God, right?
I think there is.
It's weird because like the definition of a deistic God is one that does not interact with reality in any detectable way. If it doesn't interact with reality in any detectable way, then you can't detect it, which means you can't provide evidence for it.
I can, but I need you to listen to it.
Okay, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you exactly 60 seconds without me interrupting at all, unless you say something just awful, in which case we'll disconnect you. So go ahead.
That sounds great, because I might disconnect myself. But the thing is that what we cannot detect does not mean it's not there. It doesn't negate the fact that it's there. See, I understand mathematics. It really seems like you don't understand mathematics. Not understanding that it's not there doesn't negate the fact that it is there. So I can understand that something is there, simply knowing that creation is right there in front of my face. The answer is right under your nose. So I can reverse engineer that, use the reduction to absurdity argument in an intermediate way, not a very simple way, because you don't seem to understand what that is. Reduce the fact that there are so many things in this world that we do not even understand where it comes from, and there are so many effects. We understand a cause causes an effect. The first domino is God. Period. That's the deity that I know exists. Done.
Okay. Well, thank you for wasting our time, Zeno. I'm going to move on to callers who don't just sit here and tell me how little I don't know while they you talked. Now shut
you're
the fuck
an idiot.
Up.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up, dude.
Yeah, you just wanted to call in. What, you just wanted to call in and call me names and say I was stupid. Here's the problem.
What is his point?
I'm going to get to that because I can completely debunk Zeno without him ever being on the show again. So, by the way, call screeners, ban him. Welcome to ban Zeno. So here's the thing. He wants to call in and say that I don't understand this, and he can get to it with a reductio ad absurdum. But what he started with is really simple. He said, what we can't detect doesn't mean that it's not there. I completely agree. If Zeno would have hung around, we could have handled this really simply, because my position is not there is not a deistic God. My position is you cannot have evidence that would warrant believing that there is a deistic God. So when he says that just because we can't detect something doesn't mean it's not true, he's correct. But the only way we can know that it's true is to be able to detect it and show evidence for it. And if his argument for a deistic God is that he can simply look at creation, it's right in front of his face and he can know it, and he wants to use reductio ad absurdum at an intermediate level. Well, first of all, there are not basic or intermediate levels of a reductio ad absurdum. The argument is to reduce something to the absurd to show a contradiction and therefore confirm that the premise that you began by assuming is false. So he doesn't understand that he can't use it in an intermediate way, and that simply saying that your argument for a deistic God is to look around and see it in front of your face. We've had week after week of Zeno calling in just basically to call me names. I'm a narcissist. I don't understand math. I'm just too stupid for all of this. It's so obvious. It's right in front of his face. Congratulations, Zeno. Welcome to ban. Hey, Dave, you want to take real callers today? Because I'm in the
Yeah, I knew that would be fun and brief. Bye-bye, Zeno. Let's go to Lisa's been here a while, over an hour waiting. So Lisa in Colorado. She's exploring her religion, having trouble with some of the things I'm finding in the Old Testament. You want to click on?
I've got it. Welcome, Lisa. You're on with Dave Warnock and Matt. Lisa, you're on the air.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Matt and Dave? Oh, okay, good. At first it sounded like you couldn't hear me. Just briefly, I was raised Lutheran, and then in my late teens, my family switched over to Pentecostal. Well, I'm in my 50s now, and recently, say maybe half a year ago or so, I seriously started to investigate things and review what I was raised to believe, and that's when I started coming across certain videos on YouTube, including Atheist Experience, Talk Heathen, and marvelous videos by Hemant Mehta.
Yeah.
That take you through the Old Testament one chapter at a time. I have found that to be absolutely invaluable. And in addition to that, I've also been reading up on various sciences, the latest discoveries and so forth. I'm certainly not an expert on any of them, but I wanted at least an overview. And curiously, with all this exploring, it seems that my investigation is, I guess I'd say it's coalescing around the character of God. And that's not necessarily what I set out specifically to investigate, but nevertheless, that's what's coming up. And just very recently, I was reading two particular chapters in Exodus, and I saw a certain debate yesterday. In fact, Matt, you were in it with Glenn Scrivener, if I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly.
I believe Glenn and I did a debate when I was in the UK on I think it's Justin Brierley's Unbelievable show.
Yes, that's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyhow, two relevant to the character of God, two red flags have popped up in my mind. I'd love to run them past you gentlemen in case you have any insights or suggestions as to what may be good reading for me on this topic. The first red flag is a comparison, for lack of a better term, between a couple of things I read in Exodus 21 and Exodus 26. And in fact, I'll briefly interject that, yes, as I grew up, I was aware of some of the bizarre atrocities in the Old Testament, such as Abraham being commanded to sacrifice Isaac. But there were quite a few things I had absolutely no knowledge of. But thanks to a bunch of videos by you, Matt, and other people, I've learned quite a bit, particularly regarding slavery. But the only reason why I mentioned slavery tonight, it's not the usual argument, because as far as I can see, there's nothing to debate there. Clearly, sure, the Bible condones it. I mean, there's just no debate on that. But specifically, when we get to Exodus 21, verses 20 and 21, particularly 21, when it says, but if the slave survives a day or two, the slave owner is not to be avenged because the slave is his money or his property. And, you know, unless I'm mistaken, that seems so utterly cavalier to me about, it's so utterly discarding of a person. And then if we hop over to Exodus 26, which I started reading recently, verses 1 through 14, they're all about specifications for the curtains that are supposed to be in a tabernacle of God. And this is one of the red flags that is coming up, and it absolutely breaks my heart. I won't deny that. But to me, it seems there's something really very disgustingly incongruous here. You know, two statements are devoted to a slave who's beaten, and yet we have four statements devoted to the specifications of curtains. And there's something very disproportionate in that, very incongruous in that, and that's one of the red flags. So would you like to address that, or would you like me to quickly mention the other red flag?
I just say I agree with you. It's a red flag, but it's one of many. For instance, there's 14 verses there about how to make the curtains for the tabernacle, but there aren't really any verses that allow women to own property. In fact, there's only a couple verses that allow that specifically describe that women can't own property. So there's a ton of things where the Bible and evidently God, the all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-wise governor of the universe, just seems to care more about, you know, whether or not you should boil a kid in its mother's milk, or how you should do the curtains, than whether or not slaves are people and whether or not women should be considered equal. Yeah. Dave?
Well, we could spend the next 5 hours talking about the various passages in the Old Testament that are problematic, and point out that the God of the Old Testament is a narcissistic bully. I mean, like you mentioned, the verses devoted to certain things that are ridiculous. And you just start with the Ten Commandments. You've got no mention. God is apparently more interested that we don't own graven image, or that we don't have graven images, than that we not own people. I mean, nowhere in the Ten Commandments is slavery even mentioned. And then you could just go from that on through the Old Testament. I mean, it's clear that the only way that evangelicals, and first of all, Lutheran to Pentecostal, that's quite a leap, by the way. But the only way that evangelicals and that Bible believers can make sense of the God that they want to worship is to divorce him from the Old Testament and somehow make him a different kind of God in the New Testament, a nicer God, a God of love, Jesus feeding the 5,000 and having little children come sit in his lap. But it's the same God. And the writers of the New Testament mm-hmm. make mention of the Old Testament over and over again. So you can't separate this God from the Old Testament. He is, if you're going to believe in the biblical God, you're going to have to embrace the Old Testament. And that God is an asshole. And I've said, and Matt said, and others have said over and over, you could prove to me today that the God of the Bible is real, and I still wouldn't worship him. So I'm glad that you're seeing red flags. I don't know what you identify as now, whether it's still a Christian or agnostic or atheist or in between, but the best way for a Christian to become an atheist is to read the Bible, truly read the Bible and see what it says about their God.
Amen. Mm-hmm. What was your other red flag?
Right, the other red flag pertains to that video that I had mentioned, the one that you had done with Mr. Scrivener, and I saw it only just yesterday. And one thing that came up in the, or one issue that came up during that debate was the fact that there is apparently technology that enables people to determine if they're developing babies in the womb already have Down syndrome. And if I understand Mr. Scrivener correctly, one of his main concerns about whether or not atheism can deliver a good world is that that any moral system that stems from humans rather than an external entity is so prone to narrowing the circle and excluding various groups of people from certain rights or privileges or whatever. And relevant to that, it seems to me that the Old Testament is doing precisely that. And that's another red flag that popped up to me. And
yeah.
whether it's saying, oh, females are worth only 3 shekels instead of 5, or your heathen slaves, you can treat worse than your Hebrew slaves. And granted, I'm sure there's probably much more in the Old Testament that I don't know about, but I'm only into Exodus right now.
Well, all you have to do is look at the fact that the Jews consider themselves, according to their holy scriptures, to be God's chosen people, that they are God's preferred people. The very notion that God would have a preferred group of people. Now, the Jews would like you to think that this is a burden because they have more rules to follow than Gentiles, which is technically true, but the very notion that they think they're better. And generally speaking, Christians, especially evangelical Christians, think that they have a bigger reward in heaven. You know, in my Father's house, there are many mansions. I go there to prepare a place for you. And the type of reward you're going to get in heaven is dependent upon what sort of your work you did as a tool for the Holy Spirit here on the prime material plane. When Glenn is concerned that a secular moral system will lead to inequality, he has not bothered to dig in on humanism, because as a humanist, I can say that one of the primary principles is that humans are equal. Now, do we still have problems with humanism with regard to how we view other animals? Yes. But humanism puts all of us equal. Man, woman, other. White, black, other. And I would say slave and other, except that humanism doesn't have an option in it for slavery. You can't own people. They cannot be property. They can't be treated as property. And so the notion that a secular world somehow leads to this inequality, Lisa, you have exactly, it's not just a red flag, you have exactly keyed in on the truth, which is there's nothing in the Bible that even hints at true equality between people. There are a couple verses that one could cherry pick to suggest that, you know, God loves Jews and Gentiles and things like that, but there's nothing in there that says truly you are all equal. As a matter of fact, the fact that we don't have women who are matriarchs, who are property owners, who are and Paul saying that he doesn't, you know, permit a woman to have authority over a man or to speak, you know, these are problems. And they're not problems with secular humanism. They are problems with any position derived from the Bible.
Mm-hmm. I dare say that that is not just biblical Christianity causing these divisions, but religion as a whole is a divisive ideology. It pits us against the other. You're either in our group or you're in the other group, and it's divisive by its very nature. And that's why I believe a world without religion, period, is a better world, because as Matt said, then we're just humans. We're not us and them. We're not good and bad. We're not right and wrong. We're not sinners and saints. We are just humans. We are people. And that is a better way to live. And I think we're going to be a better society, a more moral society worldwide when we get rid of more and more religions. I've seen both sides of this coin, and I know what the better side is, or I believe what the better side is in terms of how we live.
I guess one of the questions, Lisa, is, you know, I obviously found red flags and kudos to you, but where is this leading you, and how are you looking at it now?
I think the only honest way to describe myself at this point is that I'm on a journey, Matt, and I'm really not entirely certain exactly where it's going to lead. All sure. I know is that I'm just going to keep investigating it and keep following it, and where it leads, that's it.
Good for you. That's a good place to be.
So, by the way, for those people who ask, you know, why do we do this show? What is the goal of the show? I've talked about this many times. You're there, Lisa. My goal is not necessarily to make people atheists, or to even encourage them to be atheists or identify as an atheist or label as an atheist, although I'm happy when that happens. My goal is not to get people to give up on every religion or a specific version of a religion. The goal is to get people to ask questions, to honestly and openly explore, and to say, hey, this thing that I thought my religion was isn't what it actually is. Or the reasons that I thought I had for believing, turns out they're not particularly good ones. And to ask those questions and be honest about following the evidence wherever it leads. The fact that you don't know where you're end up, I think you're going to be just fine.
Good for you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And just in closing, relevant to something that was mentioned earlier in this little chat we've been having. It was something that Dave had mentioned, that even if God were to appear right in front of you and you knew he existed, that's certainly not automatically tantamount to meaning that you would worship him. And right. If God were to appear, if the biblical God were to appear in front of me right now and ask me, Lisa, would you worship me? I mean, with no hesitation, absolutely flat statement, I would tell him no, and I would tell him why.
Yeah,
I'd say, I've got some questions first, God.
Yeah, Lucy, you got some splaining to do.
You got some splaining to do, big guy.
Yeah, God has a lot to answer for. And that to me, I mean, I'm on record as saying that the argument from divine hiddenness and the fact that we basically don't see a God is really strong evidence that God doesn't exist. But the fact that you and I and the three of us right here, two atheists and someone who's questioning their religion, are having a conversation and we're finding problems with at least this particular version of God and this particular holy book, the fact that God isn't bothering to answer your questions, isn't showing up to explain what the truth is, isn't showing up to say, hey, you know what, those ancient Israelites managed to get some things wrong, and I'm not in favor of slavery, and the things you think about me aren't true, there's no correction, there's no interaction. It is, you are left to your own devices, which is why over 16 years on the show, I have people calling in to, you know, tell me I'm an idiot or a reprobate or whatever, and the truth is, I'm just someone who asked questions in the same way that you are and found that I didn't have a good reason to believe and am baffled that I live in a world where the majority of people still believe something despite the fact that we have no good reason to. And as you are finding, Lisa, many good reasons to not believe.
Absolutely. Well, I know is that, I mean, I've already seen enough stuff in it. I couldn't possibly align myself with it. And I mean, even I, an imperfect being, there's no way
I mean, if somebody were to command me to go kill my neighbors or whatever, I, in no uncertain terms, I would tell them what to do with themselves, because there's no way I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, by all means, Lisa, I recommend reaching out to Recovering from Religion if you want other people to talk to. You can give us a call back as you progress on your journey. If you find better evidence for God, by all means, call us back. If you find, you know, evidence that, hey, this understanding of the Bible is wrong and here's the correct one, I'm always open to hear it. But, you know, no matter where you end up, I'd love to hear back from you and find out what your discoveries were and the things that stuck out most in your head. Because despite the destination that you may arrive at, if I take a look at people in the atheist community, some of us come from very similar backgrounds, but we still got here for different reasons. The things that tipped me in the direction, the specific things that tipped me in this direction, aren't going to be the same as what tipped Dave. They're not going to be the same as what tipped Kristen or you or anybody else. People believe for different reasons, and they're going to give it up for different reasons. And so, yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Lisa. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're on an honest journey. Good for you, Lisa.
Have a great weekend.
All righty. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Happy Memorial Day.
You too.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye. Yeah, you know, Matt, God could have cleared this up long ago. You've been doing this a long time. You've got a huge audience. He could have woken you up in the middle of the night and said, hey, Matt, I got some things to tell you. Or he could have sent you an email. You know, there's so many things. Yeah. Nothing. Dead silence. Crickets.
It's really strange. But it's only strange given that there are so many people who think there is a God. And how many people, I talk about the people who want to call in and say, I'm an idiot or whatever else. That's fine. It doesn't offend me. I'm not, you know. The guy, the unqualified person who wants to say, oh, Matt's a narcissist who just wouldn't understand it. No, the thing is, there are people who are genuine, sincere believers who will contact me and say, hey, Matt, I know for a fact God loves you. God's going to do a powerful work in your life. You are going to return to the fold. I can't tell you why God hasn't done it yet, but I know that he will and all this other stuff. And I appreciate the fact that, you know, on the one hand, they're not being mean. On the other hand, they not only believe that there's a God, but they have specific beliefs about the character of this God. And yet they're admitting that this God has not done anything to demonstrate his existence or character to me, but they're sure he will someday. And their confidence is disconcerting, because those are the people who seem to have shut down reasonable discourse. That, like, you know, somebody calls in and says, oh, yeah, Matt just doesn't understand, you know, here's this and this. Those are the people who are cocksure that they have some philosophical position on a God. It's not evidence-based. You know, when it comes to evidence, what we get is, you know, look at the trees, or have you read the Bible? To which my replies are, I love trees. They don't prove God. And when somebody says, have you read the Bible? I want to ask, have you read anything else? Because it's the other things that are particularly useful.
Or probably more than you. Yeah.
Yeah. I have read it several times, but all right, where do we want to go?
Who we got next? What do you see on there you want to talk to? I like maybe Arnie from Washington.
All righty. Arnie from Washington, you are on with Dave and Matt. How are you?
I'm fabulous. How are you guys doing?
I'm pretty good. Arnie. How can we help?
Just so you know, I have a terrible cell phone. And so if I seem to talk over you, it might just be the delay. But I wanted to discuss the question you get all the time. They always ask you, Matt, in particular, what would it take to convince you of a God? And I know your answer to that, and I think it's a good answer that God would know, and he would, you know, be able to do that. But I just kind of wanted to talk about, like, it seems like there's both sides of both atheists and theists have the same problem, and it's like overcoming your preconceptions. Because I was thinking about that myself. Like, I mean, you do magic, you know that, you know, if you see something demonstrated that seems miraculous, you're still not necessarily going to believe that just because of the miraculous nature of it.
Correct.
And so I don't really know how to overcome that preconception. I would summarize it by saying that atheists basically approach it by saying, given there is no God, what's the best explanation? Whereas a theist would say, given there is a God, what's the best explanation?
And I would offer, I need to offer a correction on that, because the problem with what you're saying is, here's how an atheist approaches it, and here's how a theist approaches it. You're assuming the conclusion. because I was a theist when I approached this issue. I was a Bible-believing, Southern Baptist raised, confident, fundamentalist, evangelical Christian. The difference was I was also a skeptic. I just hadn't applied skepticism to my religion. And so when I approached this question seriously, it became not, here's how a theist tries to, you know, address this issue of whether there's a God, or here's how an atheist addresses it. It's about, here's how a skeptic addresses it. And so the real issue isn't, are you beginning as a theist or an atheist? Because that's a flaw. If you begin with the conclusion, obviously you've got some flawed reasoning there. But the real issue is to address the epistemology or the methodology behind how somebody determines what's real or true. And for me, there needs to be evidence and a sound argument for a proposition. And what I found is that all the reasons that I had for believing in a God were not sound. They weren't based on good evidence, and they were logically flawed. And so if that's the key issue here, I want Dave to answer the question, because I've answered it many times. Dave, what would change your mind or what would convince you that there's a God? Because that might help Arnie more than my answer.
I think what's been said many times by many other people is that incredible claims need incredible evidence. I mean, it's one thing for Matt to do a magic trick with some cards or rope or something. It's a parlor trick, yeah, or to remove his finger. That's a parlor trick. There's really not a lot weighing on that, you know, whether or not he really pulled his finger off or whether that was an illusion of some kind. We can debate that. We kind of understand that he probably didn't pull his finger off. That's not something most people can do or anybody can do. But when you make a claim that a God has a right to your life and a savior saved you, and you your eternal destiny hinges on what you believe about that and what you profess about that, that's an incredible claim, and it has a lot riding on it. So I need some incredible evidence for something like that. And more so, when the God that I believed in most of my adult life was a God who was involved. He answered prayer. He directed you and guided you and those kind of things. And if we have a God like that, who's supposed to be involved in his creation's activities, and then we have issues going on where a God who's involved should step in and intervene. And when we have children being raped, sex trafficking going on, we have childhood diseases where parents are praying fervently night and day for their child to be saved and healed, and the child dies. And the God that is supposed to be involved with us and compassionate and all powerful is just not there. I would start with that kind of evidence, that there's a God out there who's involved with us. Otherwise, if it's a God who's not involved with us, what difference does it make? Big deal. There's some deist God out there who spun the top out into the universe and started the world, but he's not really doing anything. That doesn't interest me. If there's not a God who's involved with us, then what's the point of even calling him a God? Yeah. And what's the point of worshiping him? So I would start with needing some evidence for that kind of a God, and I just don't see it, never have.
I want to give you some time here, Arnie, both to tell us what would change your mind and what you think about this, and continue on with, if we kind of sidetracked, if you had a different question.
No. I'm kind of in your book, Matt, in your book now. It's I keep thinking about, like, okay, even if I witness these miraculous things, I'm still going to think maybe maybe I'm having some kind of, like, okay, for instance, I'm an ex-Mormon, and I used to think, and we were kind of taught this, that, okay, Joseph Smith was either a liar or he was telling the truth and he really witnessed this phenomenal event of seeing God. Now I kind of think, well, he could have even have been convinced himself. He didn't have to be a fraud to be wrong. He could have had some kind of condition or mental illness. I mean, there's all kinds of explanations. And so now I'm kind of stuck, because maybe it's just an unfalsifiable thing, period, where there is no evidence that would, you know, be evidence enough. I don't know. I'm kind of stuck on that.
Can I ask a question real quick, like, Arnie?
You
said, you alluded to something, and I want to make it clear, because you said if you keep witnessing miraculous things, you don't even know that you could reasonably conclude that they were from a God or whatever. And so I want to know, what miraculous things do you keep witnessing? Because I've never witnessed anything miraculous at all.
Fair question. I've had, maybe five experiences in my life that I would, as a Mormon, I would have described as revelation. Now looking back, I'm just sort of getting more and more comfortable saying I don't know what those were. But each time it was, what makes me a little bit suspicious that it might have been me is that each of those moments when I experienced this profound, overwhelming, you know, comfort and love from what I felt like was outside myself, it was all those times I was in an extremely vulnerable emotional position.
Sure.
And so, but that doesn't negate the possibility that that was some sort of, you know, revelation or comfort from God.
So I have a couple other questions.
Sure.
And to be honest, these are questions that are intended to reach some sort of exposition. So without going into detail about what you experienced, I was reminded of a caller who called in recently to talk about how he was thinking about marrying this woman, and he prayed to God and he said, God, I'm going to open the Bible and I want you to give me a message. And he opened the Bible to a seemingly random place. And right off the bat, it was some passage in the Bible that said, do not marry or something like that. And he took that as a message from God. And that was, by the way, his strong evidence. You know, we said, hey, present your best case. What's your strongest evidence for God? That's what he presented. Now, when you talk about things that you consider to be revelation and you were in a low point, here's two things to ask yourself and consider. And I'm going to tie this to the other caller just so that, you know, you're on the periphery and I'm not coming at you. I'd love to ask the other caller if he thinks that God, the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-wise governor of the universe, is allowing children to starve and get malaria and allowing wars and sex trafficking, but took time out to send him a vague message by having him open a book and find a particular scripture that he could interpret as if it were from God. That doesn't make sense to me. You know, Dave's talking about we need a God that is, you know, that is interactive or that is participatory with us. It doesn't make sense to me that if God actually wants to tell you, hey, don't marry this person, that you would have to open a book and find a passage. And it doesn't make sense that this God is keen to play your particular game, not you, obviously, Arnie, but your particular game of, okay, God, I'm going to open the book now, and you, and I'm, whatever I find, that's what I'm going to do. I would think that if God has a message for you, why can't he just tell you? Why is there any ambiguity at all? Why could you ever be in a position where you think at one point you got a message from God, and later you're like, you know, maybe that was me? Because I would think if there was a message from God, not only would it be clear to you instantly and forever, but if you ever had a weird doubt, God could clear that up for you. Clearly, if God's given you one message, then he should be able to give you another one and confirm, yes, in fact, that was me. I did send you that message. I did give you that piece of revelation. And the world doesn't make sense if that's true, but it does make sense if people credit a fictional God with things that they don't want to take responsibility for or that they aren't sure they can take responsibility.
That's a little bit to that, and then I'll let you respond to that. But I like to think of it in terms of, I mean, I'm a father, and our Christian religion Bible tells us to think of God as a father, our Father who art in heaven, right? So I can't imagine any of my kids, me playing this kind of hide-and-seek game with any of my kids. If there were messages that I felt like were important for me to present to them, get to them, things that I felt like were important for them to know, and they came to me with a question, Dad, what do you think about this? I can't imagine me just spitting out some kind of a riddle and them going away confused and perplexed and wondering, and did Dad mean this? Did he mean that? What was he trying to tell me? It's such a mystery. Yeah. What is he trying to tell me? And then me saying, you're going to have to figure that out. You know, I can't tell you everything. Well, Dad, it's important. You know, it's really important, this thing I'm asking you. Well, too bad. You know, here's another riddle. And that's kind of how God seems to do. And people, what you're explaining, maybe it was God, maybe it wasn't. Well, was it? Why is it so complicated? This God who wants to communicate with us, and apparently there are really important things he wants to communicate with us, but he just can't seem to get through. And I encourage you to ask yourself that. Why is he so damned complicated? You know, why is he so evasive and elusive? Why, like he's playing some kind of a game with us? Because that's what it sure seems like.
Those are both fair criticisms. Let me give you my former Mormon perspective. I assume you both saw Karate Kid?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So yeah. I thought of the whole interaction with God, you know, and having to trust and not understand what he was doing. It's kind of like when he said, you know, wax on, wax off, wash this, wash that. So when he was doing those things, he didn't know why he was doing it, but he was trusting in this authority figure that it would later on make sense, or there'd be some purpose in doing it.
The problem is Mr. Miyagi was real and was actually there communicating. This isn't just, hey, God gave me a message and I'm not sure what it means. It's, I got a message and I don't know it's from God. So it would be like Daniel walking over to a place where he's told there's a karate master, and he just gets the feeling that the karate master wants him to paint the fence.
That's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when I was a Christian, everything was so complicated. And whenever I had a thought as a Christian, I had to try to discern, is this from God? Is it from the devil? Could it be Satan? Or is it just my own flesh interjecting? And it was just this puzzle that I had to try to sort out. There was nothing clear. And this was me trying my best to hear God's voice, trying my very best on a daily basis to hear and understand God's voice and God's will. And yet, even with that, it was just this complicated morass of just, whose voice is this? And it's just, like Matt said earlier, life just makes so much more sense when you take that out of the equation.
Yeah. No, thank you guys. One quick question for Dave. Dave, it's an honor to talk to you. Is the shower curtain still available?
Yes, it is. Go to my website, daveoutloud.com. You click on the merch thing. You can get a shower. You can get a shower curtain with my face on it. I think it's around $40. I mean, for the price of $40, you can shower with Dave. I mean, how great is that?
That's amazing. All right.
Thank you, man.
Thank you both. Thank you both.
Appreciate it. Appreciate it.
Well, Matt, somebody has actually ordered the shower curtain. I saw a picture of it.
I'm going to order one as soon as we're off the air, because I'd like to shower with Dave.
Well, who wouldn't?
I'm getting side eye from the other side of the room now. But
you should.
All right. I want to go to Israel.
Okay.
So is it Cyril? Or Sorel, I apologize. I don't know how to pronounce your name. And Israel has a question for us about atheism and spirituality. So, welcome.
Hi, Matt, and hi, Dave. It's Sorel.
Hey, man.
Nice to meet you, Sorel. Thanks for waiting.
Hey,
Sorel. Yes.
Thank you. It's great. Love you both you guys. And I was raised as an Orthodox Jew, and jumped through many, many different religious hoops. I was a Messianic Jew for a period of time, even went through Norse paganism, all sorts of other paganism. And now I'm an atheist. And I have found myself recently looking into spirituality, yoga in particular. And there's a lot of things within those types of Eastern religions, and I don't know if you can call them philosophies, that are very appealing, and they seem like they'll help. It'll help to, in life, but then again, there's a lot of woo, and I'm afraid that, I mean, I want, on the one hand, I want to take the good and the meditation and all that stuff from it, but on the other hand, I'm afraid maybe I'll get sucked back in to the, you know, woo or whatever. And I mean, I know that I'm a skeptical person, and I try to be as skeptical as possible. So I wanted to hear what your opinion on spirituality as an atheist, and how to approach these subjects.
Well, thanks for the question. I, So first of all, I don't know what the word spirituality means, because it seems to mean different things to different people. I understand what you're saying right. about there being pseudoscience in woo and things like yoga, et cetera. For example, I had a wonderful breakfast this morning at a Buddhist temple. And I went in the temple and looked around. And of course, there was a video of instruction. And I can't stop my brain from thinking about what it's being presented with. And so on the video, the instructor was talking about the five parts of the body. And part one was the head and neck. And part two was the shoulders and arms. And part three was the torso. And part four was the legs and feet. And part five was the whole body. And my brain went, hang on, put on the damn brakes here. The whole body is not a part of the body. You divided the whole body into these things, and you told me there were going to be five, but I would almost rather that he said, and the fifth part of the body is the spirit, because then I could have just said, oh, well, this is some pseudoscience.
That's what I thought you were going to.
Yeah, that's where I thought he was going. But instead, he didn't go to that. He didn't go to anything that was supernatural. But what it reminds me, Dan Dennett's daughter coined this wonderful term, which I've used many times, and it's deepity. And so a deepity describes something, a statement that to the it sounds impressive or significant, but to the extent that it is true, it is actually trivial. And to the extent that it is profound, it is actually false. So when you say you're going to divide the body into five sections, and one of those is the whole body, to the extent that that is profound, it is clearly false, because that's not the case. I would say, for me, if you are finding that you are learning something and you're enjoying participating in some sort of exercise, be it, you know, meditation or yoga or whatever else, that until somebody tells you you have to buy into the pseudoscience and the woo as well, mm-hmm. there's absolutely nothing wrong. I would love to be good at meditating. I'm just not any good at it. There are real tangible benefits to secular science-based meditation. I don't have to put any woo in it to get benefits out of it.
Mm-hmm. My thought on that, Sorrel, is I think like what Matt said, if to me, it's the certainty that kills things. So if you've got, if you find benefit from a spirituality or woo or whatever, meditation, yoga, whatever kind of thing calms you or comforts you, and you're not imposing that idea on others, then it's fairly harmless. The only thing I would, and I actually got, I didn't really think about this until I got a message just yesterday from a follower in the Netherlands, and a young man, a new friend, and he had seen some shows, and I talk a lot about dying, my dying out loud work and death. And so what I had talked about somehow had helped him, because he had been a spiritual person and the woo, and he had found himself being sucked into this idea of fear of death and the fear of what's beyond death. And somehow that spirituality and that idea of opening self up to the universe and energy and something out there beyond himself had generated this idea that, well, if that's true, then I can't fathom the idea of just ending and things just stopping and me ceasing to exist. But then he got afraid of what's beyond that. And so it kind of swirled in his head and kind of got confusing and disorienting for him. So that to me is a cautionary tale about opening up to ideas that there's not evidence. My departure from Christianity was complete, and I never felt the need to go look for a nicer God or some other form of spirituality to give me comfort. I just felt like whatever's real and true, I would find evidence for, and reason and logic would guide me. And I didn't need something beyond what I could understand. And if I couldn't understand it, I just thought, well, I don't really care. And so it doesn't matter. And even when I've gotten this diagnosis with ALS and I'm facing an earlier end than I thought I would, I never felt the need to look for something beyond that. I was okay with just living this life. In fact, it enhanced the value of this life and the value of the moments that I find in this life, so much so that thinking beyond this was just an exercise in futility for me. But if you, I'll just finish with going back to what I said, if you find comfort and some kind of pleasure in that and it doesn't harm anyone else, I find no inherent harm in that. You know, is I think the harm comes when we try to impose our ideologies on someone else.
Right. So, yeah, and what I wanted to say in regards to what you said, Dave, was first of all, I've heard of many episodes of yours, and I found that your journey is very empowering and amazing. And yeah, what you said is it reminds me of a passage from the Norse pagan Havamal, where it says, and it's my favorite, and I don't remember anything much else from the Havamal, men die and cattle die, but there's one thing that lives forever, and that's a man's reputation. And I try to live my life by that, because I don't know if I'm going to live forever or not. I don't know if there's an afterlife or not. What I do know is that once I do die, the only thing that people remember of me would be my reputation and what I left here for humanity. And yeah,
that's good.
So your story, you know, reminds me of that a lot. And yeah, I mean, and like what Matt said regarding to the don't know the definition of spirituality. I mean, I've heard that a lot. I've listened to a lot of episodes. And the thing is yeah, a lot, everybody has a different explanation for spirituality. I personally think that spirituality isn't of the spirit, but it's more of the mind, consciousness, ego, and like the whole mess of things that if we had a Shannon on the show, she would go into yes. that deeply. But yeah, so it's these things that we're, you know, touching on in science, and they have been explored for centuries through, you know, different just techniques and things like that. And that's more what I call spirituality. And the strange thing is that in Hebrew, the word for psychiatry is bri'ut ha-nefesh, health of the spirit. And they conflate kind of this notion of the spirit and the psychiatry. And it's just an interesting kind of mix that they do in Hebrew.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I don't run around going, oh, whatever you mean by spirituality, it's bullshit. I don't do that because I want to find out, first of all, tell me what you mean by spirituality. Because for some people, when they say, oh, I had a spiritual experience, all they mean is they had some indescribable, ineffable feeling that was a connection with other people. And I've felt those things. And not just on drugs. I mean, obviously, those sorts of experiences we can certainly experience when we're chemically altered. But I mean, if I go, I've been to botanical gardens, and, you know, altered and not altered, but I've had wonderful experiences with that. I've looked at the stars. I've been in Perth, Australia, standing out in a field, looking at the southern stars that I'd never seen before in my life through a telescope. And it was awe-inspiring. It was as close to getting goosebumps as any sermon I've ever participated in, or any standing up in church and singing praises to God, the euphoria that people get. That sort of thing, I know what they're talking about. When I object to the use of the term spiritual and spirituality, I'm trying to show people something, and that is most of us have used the word spiritual and spirituality in conversation with other people when there is no good reason to think that we're both talking about the same thing. The word is just too fungible.
I'm the same, Matt. I don't have any problem with people identifying things that they can't explain or that move them. I mean, I remember flying in a helicopter over the Grand Canyon and being moved to tears with the sheer beauty of it. What I didn't need to do in that moment, though, was transcribe that to some sort of God experience. And that's the difference between, you know, when we move away from the idea that there's a God out there doing things, that we can just experience things. Even there are things that happen that we can't explain. But again, we don't have to say, well, there's a God involved in that. And so that's the difference. And spirituality beyond that is really fine. It doesn't matter.
Right. And what I want to say about that was that when it comes to the Eastern religions, Buddhism and yoga, and you might know, is that they, like, Buddhism is technically an atheistic, they're atheists.
Mm-hmm.
But they have these things, and they have, like, this whole, the deeper I and the Dharma, the universe kind of eternity essence stuff, and that's where, you know, I'm trying to, like, not get lost in, because it's it's very interesting, the whole, where like some a friend of mine said, there's the mind and then there's the I behind the mind. Like when you're looking at the world through your mind, who's doing the looking? And it's mm-hmm. like you get in, and I'm not sure if that's, like you said, is that a deepity or is that actually something that you, that I should, you know, go into and explore?
Yeah, it's I think quite often what we're seeing is metaphor. That when they're talking about the mind's eye, they're not talking about an actual eye or an eye that's tied to something supernatural, but a metaphorical eye, which is, mm-hmm. it could be viewed as,
right,
your brain builds a model of reality. And if you had a metaphorical eye, it could build a model of reality that is different. Now, where I have problems with, well, I have lots of problems with, for example, Buddhism, because they have issues with class inequality, same as Hinduism does. And they have issues with slavery and human rights and things like that. There is potentially a lot of woo there. And so mm-hmm. if somebody told me, you know, hey, you need to, you know, if I was sitting there with Bill Hicks and he told me to squeegee my third eye, I'd ask him what he was talking about. And if he said, oh, I'm talking about a metaphorical construct that is how your brain perceives reality. If you are, you know, coming from a cishet, straight, privileged, white upbringing in the West, and I, you know, which I am, and I look at the world, I'm going to see things in a certain way. And it's not going to be possible for me to truly see things as, let's say, an African-American trans woman would see the world. But it may be possible for me to get closer to that with some sort of training in how to force my brain to model the world from a perspective that was once foreign to me through this process of familiarization. And if that's what somebody meant by, you know, hey, let's get the eye behind your brain, I could get behind that, because all you're really doing is saying, we're going to train your brain to think about things by removing as much of the baggage about you as possible. And to some extent, my limited understanding of some versions of Buddhism, that this death of the self, I think that's what they're trying to do. I don't understand it, and I don't see it as anything that we need to put into language that would be confusing or spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I appreciate the call.
Thank you, Cyril.
Thank you very much.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Hey, Matt.
You too.
Yes, sir.
I know who you want to talk to next.
Yeah.
We're going to find out why God will allow slaves.
Oh, yeah. We've got Jacob in Connecticut wants to explain to us why God would allow slaves. Welcome, Jacob.
I don't know if you've ever talked about slavery on this show or not, Matt, but it's a good
once or twice
here now. Okay.
So, hey, Jacob, welcome to the show. You wanted to tell us why God would allow slaves.
Yeah, I had a thought that I wanted to run by. It's not necessarily scripture, but it's inferred through scripture. So I've listened to your show in the past. Slaves is a recurring topic. And so I've been thinking about it. And my answer that I would come up with is that God never encouraged slavery. If you can find a Bible verse where he encouraged it, then I would start to agree with you a little bit, but...
Okay, hang on. What you said is that you were going to defend why God would allow slavery. And personally, I don't care, but I mean, if you're going to come up with something, but when God could say, thou shalt not own a human being as property, but instead he's presented as saying in the Bible, you shall buy your slaves from the heathen that surround you, and that these slaves are your money and your property, and that you can pass them on, how is that not God saying it's okay and encouraging it?
What I would say to that is, as far as him making it a commandment, I don't know that one. But as far as like the rule, the ordinances, that in my opinion, it's not that he's saying it's okay. He's saying you guys are going to do this anyways. So
Jacob, you're about to make yourself look really foolish, and I'm going to save you from that. So I expect to thank you when I'm done here. I don't know why you are bending over backwards to try to find some excuse for why the Bible endorses, sanctions, and allows for slavery, but you're trying to do it. And what you're doing is you're saying God said, hey, you guys are going to do this anyway, so I'm going to make some rules about slavery so that you're not complete assholes about it, so that you don't kill people who are your slaves. Here's the problem. Is slavery, is owning another person immoral?
Shouldn't have to think about it.
This is really fucking easy. I'm trying to help you out.
Shouldn't have to think about it.
Is it immoral to own people as property?
Physical ownership?
Is it immoral to own people as... Why is this so fucking hard? Never mind. Jacob, shut up. You're done. I'm gonna still... No. You're muted.
I have one.
You are muted. I'm going to help you so that you don't look worse. That should have been one of the easiest questions.
I don't think you can help him. If you can't answer that, Matt, I'm sorry.
I know. So it's one of the easiest questions you can ask. Is it immoral to own people's property? But Jacob's position is that, first of all, he can't answer that question. And now he wants to make excuses for why the Bible allows for slavery. And his excuse, which I've heard many, many, many times, is God thinks you're going to do it anyway. And so let's just soften it. Well, this is the same God that made it against his code to eat shellfish, to wear mixed mm-hmm. fabrics. Your God gives more of a fuck about shrimp than it does about whether or not mm-hmm. You should be.
He could have said, hey, you people are going to eat shrimp anyway, so let me tell you how to peel them.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to peel them this way and not that way. But he didn't do
that.
What
the hell?
Jacob, no. You have sacrificed your human decency on the altar of the Bible. It is absolutely embarrassing, and you should feel embarrassed that you could not speak up and say, this is immoral, and I have no reason, I have no understanding of why the Bible permits it. But instead, you specifically called into a show, broadcast to the entire world, to try to make up some post hoc, pull it out your ass excuse for why God allows for slavery. And when asked the simplest question, you could not say that slavery was immoral. You should feel bad about that, but here's your chance to correct it all. What do you have to say, Jacob?
I would say that, one, you guys are doing a very...
We're damned?
Job of not, no, I'm saying you guys are doing a good job of not carrying a civil conversation. But
So your response you to me... No.
Okay, let it... explain it to us, Jacob.
Jacob?
Explain your... Go ahead.
You guys are interrupted me before when I had...
I'm going to drop you like a hot fucking rock. I have done everything to help you. Jacob, what do you have to say for yourself? Why are you making excuses for gross immorality?
You've been more rude to me than any other person I've ever heard you speak to.
Correct, because you are refusing to acknowledge that slavery is immoral. You deserve someone to be rude to you so that it wakes you up and snaps you out of this haze you're in, where you feel like you have to make excuses for an ancient book. What do you have to say for yourself, Jacob? Don't say how rude I am. What do you have to say for how absolutely dehumanizing your view is?
If you would let me answer, I would say that the culture back then was extremely different in terms of knowledge, in terms of resources, in terms of...
Jacob, you're not listening and you're making excuses. It doesn't matter whether the culture back there was different. You are making stupid excuses, and I'm done trying to save you. Goodbye, sir.
How many times have we heard this same thing?
I hear it all the time.
It's the culture. God knew they were going to do it anyway.
Hey,
God was trying to work them toward a better culture, but they were still stuck in that. But it didn't stop him, like you said, from the mixed fabrics and from the shellfish and all the other regulations.
Yeah, the culture was eating shrimp, too.
Oh, my God.
That's the thing. If you're going to try to make an excuse for God, you have to make sure that it applies to multiple problems, not just one. And so
there's two scenarios here. Either God did endorse slavery or didn't give a shit that they were owning each other and beating each other, or God is not there and God was not involved in that, and men were just writing things of their own accord, according to their own ideas and according to their own culture.
Yeah.
Choose one. It can't be both.
At least, you know, I've done a couple of discussions with Ray Comfort, and there are people who hope that I never do another one, and I don't plan to do another one. But at least when Ray Comfort was asked about this, when he called into the show, he pointed out that he doesn't believe everything in the Bible and that he believes slavery is immoral. Now, I don't know why. Well, I do know why Jacob can't do it. Jacob's, you know, oh, well, maybe God did it for this reason. Maybe God did it for that reason. Please stop making excuses. It's much better if you would just say, hey, that part of the Bible is immoral and I don't understand it. That part of the moral Bible is gross, and it should be rejected.
I think he's, if you're stuck in the mindset, and here that's where I was too, that everything in the Bible is true. It's all God's written word. It's infallible. It's inspired. So you can't dodge any of it, because if you dodge any of it, then you're cherry picking.
Yep.
And that was not something we figured we could do if we were Bible believing Christians. So I think Jacob falls in that category where he's got to defend it because it's written. And yep. it's just a terrible position to be in.
It is terrifying. I mean, I wasn't kidding. You know what would have pleased me more than anything is for Jacob to say, "Wow, I hadn't thought about that. Thank you." I mean, we know that's not likely to happen. But
well, he said at the outset that he had heard the show before, so I thought, why in the hell is he running this argument back around?
Yeah, but if my question is, what do you have to say for yourself? And you come back with, "Well, you were rude to me." Well, you fucking deserved it. Because you dismissed the bulk of humanity and human rights and human equality. And you did it. You sacrificed yourself. So first of all, that's the way the culture was. God was just working with him. What kind of weak-ass God do you worship that he can't tell people, "Thou shalt not own humans as property"?
He's bound to the culture. Yeah. That's the omnipotent God. He's bound to whatever the culture is.
That is kindergarten theology.
Oh, my God.
And this is what we get quite often.
Jacob, if you're still watching, I'm embarrassed for you. Seriously. Yeah,
even when I was a Christian, I would not have said anything as stupid as that. That is such a low level of that is somebody who's never looked at the Bible. And on that front, I'd love for Jacob to just sit down and think about it. But Jacob already showed that when pressed, he's just going to say that I'm rude and I interrupted. So,
It's easier to do that than to actually have to examine his own ideas.
You may be correct, Jacob. I may have interrupted, but at least I don't sanction slavery.
Where are we going next?
We're going to take Walter in Washington, who's been waiting quite a while with some question about objective moral oughts or way to prove them. How you doing, Walter?
Hi, Matt. Thank you for taking my call. I'm my first caller. Thank you for taking my call. Yes,
sure.
It's about moral oughts. A little bit of history, in your conversations with Cosmic Skeptic, I saw that the issue of morality, and especially objective morality, is something that is like way at the disadvantage, the atheists, right?
So I'm having a hard time understanding you.
Oh, sorry. Maybe my microphone is. Can you hear me better?
That's a little better. So you wanted to talk about how we can derive moral oughts. Because I don't think we can, so you seem to think we can. So go ahead.
And you are correct. Yes, we cannot derive logically moral odds, but we can.
Okay. Hang on. Right? I have to ask you something then. Yes. So I don't think we can derive moral odds, and you just told me I was correct. But I thought you were calling in to say that we could.
I'm calling to say that we can infer moral odds, and actually in a transcendental way, an objective way.
But you just told me I was right when I said that you couldn't.
Correct. You are right that we cannot derive them in a logical way, logically.
If all you're going to do is say that we can infer them, that's not objective. That's just your opinion.
Oh yeah, that I wanted to demonstrate that is not just my opinion.
Okay, go ahead, give it a shot.
Okay. Here it goes. So. Transcendental objective moral odds can be inferred by many types of beings, including animals and humans, right? And that's my proposition, right?
The problem is that you say inferred.
Yes, not derived, infer.
Okay, keep going.
Okay, and a way to demonstrate that. Currently, in the last 2-3 years, probably 4 years, there's been an advance artificial intelligence, and these are machine learning algorithms. These are called reinforcement learning, right? And especially the area of policy learning in machine learning is something that if you read associated the fancy words that they have, they pretty much can get a neural network to infer an ought automatically.
Okay. Stop. Right? Stop.
Yep. Yes.
You just said they can get a neural network to pretty much infer an ought. That is not
yes.
the same as saying that we can derive objective moral mm-hmm. oughts. That is not even in the same ballpark. And you started by saying absolutely. That these can they be inferred. No, you started by saying these can be inferred by many types of beings. But I don't want you to keep telling me about inferred by many types of beings or telling me what can happen with an AI. I want you to make an evidence-based case for your position.
Okay, evidence-based case. So as evidence, right, there is a type of this neural network can learn the rules of how to exist in an artificial environment just by being exposed to it. It has not been programmed or pre-programmed to do it, but it can learn it, right? And in a similar way, I propose, right, that animals, from very simple animals,
Stop.
Okay, sorry. Yep.
You haven't done a thing to explain. You just asserted neural networks can learn rules without any programming. That's bullshit. There is programming involved. Now, for example, when I follow like AlphaGo or the various AIs that have learned about chess, all it was taught was the basic rules of chess, and then it played itself and completely learned everything that the world has discovered about chess in a matter of hours. But it still had to learn the basic rules of the game. And so there was still some level of programming there. It's not just like you could turn an AI on and it would figure out all of the rules and the goal of the game and come up with a strategy. Because the core to have any strategy, to make a conclusion about what the ought should be, you have to know what the goal is.
Correct. Yes. Okay, let me expand a little bit there.
But AI in chess knows what the goal is.
Okay, yes, you are correct in that these are programmed, but they are not programmed in the case of the rules, most of the rules. They have to have some programming, right, to just exist in the computer, right, to actually run. I'm a computer programmer. So, yes, they need to have some programming, but the important part that is what they call the policy, which is pretty much a rule or an ought. That is the part that is learned. That rule or ought.
Then you're doing. No, stop. We have to stop again. You are doing what I did many years ago, and I was corrected on it. When someone challenged me to solve the is-ought problem, I made the case that you can't derive an ought from an is, but that you could derive an ought from two is statements. And what was pointed out to me then is that I was smuggling in the ought, because the two is statements that I included were the current state and the goal. Well, yes, once you tell it what the goal is, but when you talk about moral truths, when you talk about determining what we ought to do, all of that is contingent upon what the goal is. And you're not gonna, you can have opinions about the goal, but nobody knows what the goal is. How do you know that the goal isn't to kill everybody else on the planet and be the last ones around?
That's a great point. Yeah. Let me expand that in this case, in the biological beings, right? Imagine that we have a very simple organism, right, that starts killing everybody around, right? It's the only one that's left.
Yeah.
Right, and does it pretty much automatically. And it could kill its own offspring.
Yes. Right?
So its DNA will not survive that process, right? So at some point, evolutionarily, its DNA will discover at least the basic rule of don't kill your offspring.
No, right? No. You are assuming right there that the goal is to carry on your genetic code. You are assuming that is true. That is the ought that you are smuggling in. You have no way to demonstrate that it is objectively true that for one's DNA to propagate is the goal. You have assumed a goal. That is the flaw. It's the same flaw that I made years ago, Walter. You are simply wrong. You cannot derive an ought from an is. You have to say, here's the goal. And you just did that because you assumed that the creature will discover, oh, don't kill your offspring or else your genetic code won't continue. But that assumes the goal of not of having your genetic code continue. And that is not an objective, demonstrable fact that it should be a goal. I'm sorry, but you're not going to get there. Thanks, though.
Okay. I understand that there's very little time. Just read a little bit about reinforcement learning and
Walter
learning within it.
Walter, okay. I find it really disturbing that you're trying to give me fucking homework when I just spotted the flaw in your argument. I don't need to read more about this. Go read more about the Izzat problem.
Oh my! Thank you, Walter.
And Walter, you're a great guy. You made the same mistake that I made many years ago, and it was in a debate with John Ferrer, where John rightly pointed out that I was smuggling in the odd, and you did the same thing. You don't get to give me reading homework when I just proved you wrong.
Use this as a learning experience, but a nice guy.
It's great, and it's a common mistake. One of the things why these battles between, for example, Sam Harris and others about morality, when Sam wrote The Moral Landscape, it largely agreed with my position, and I would reference it. And people said, yes, but even if you say that you're going to define morality as well-being, yes, you can, you can derive objective truths of how to achieve well-being once you assume that well-being is the goal. But everybody's objection is, where is the demonstration that we should care about well-being? I would agree, right. And I agree with Sam, that we in fact do care about well-being. I also agree with Sam that well-being is what we really mean when we're talking about morality. But so the people who are objecting to Sam's position are basically saying, yes, but why do we care about morality even after you've defined it that way? And on every turn, if you want to claim that you're getting from is to ought, you have to smuggle in the very goal, passing on your DNA.
You just need to read this book, Matt. It's like people tell me I don't believe in God. Well, here, have you thought about this book?
And it's funny because once they figure out you know more about the Bible than they do, the book they want you to read is never the Bible. It's what Lee Strobel said. It's what Greg Bahnsen said. It's what Alvin Plantinga said. And I'm like, hang on. If all of these great Christian theologians are required reading before I can understand this ancient book that everybody in your church just takes at face value. I mean, has your pastor read this stuff that you recommended? And by the way, does he tell the people in the pews, or does he just say, because you were raised as a child, singing on the bus, saying, Jesus loves me, this I know. And what's the next line there? It's not because evidence told me so. It's because the Bible told me so. We've taught kids from the youngest age that Jesus loves you. And the proof of this, the evidence for this, is because the Bible says so. Well,
and then the volumes of books that were written to explain what the Bible means.
Yeah.
Okay, so absolutely. I certainly am not interested in hearing about the prophecy from the book of Daniel to back up historical evidence, but I am curious about God's reasons for being hidden, because that's one of my biggest issues with God.
Well, in that case, welcome Kenny in Oklahoma, who wants to give God's reasons for being hidden, and that's what Dave wants to talk about. So welcome, Kenny. Thank you.
Hi, Dave. Appreciate you.
Hi, Kenny.
I'm sorry for the trials that you're under. Or trial that you're under now with your health and everything, and very
thank
sympathetic
you.
Towards that. And
thank you.
I'm a theist and a Christian, and one of the things that God is he's constantly helping me out with is that when I have a personal doubt or someone has a question that challenges me, and things happen in my life, and I want to know what's going on, God usually directs me towards a book. And I was really thought of this, looking at this hiddenness of God aspect, and the academic gentleman, don't remember his name, very long last name with an S, that came up with this argument and published it, and everyone made a big deal out of it. And it seemed to really bother people. And it was being used, of course, by Matt and others, and hi, Matt, and the reason why, you know, God's not being much of a God. And so I ran across this book by Richard Elliott Freeman called The Hidden Face of God. It used to be titled The Disappearance of God, because when the phrase in the Hebrew, my God, why hast thou forsaken me, is stated, it's actually saying, why did you disappear? You were here a moment ago. Now you're not with me when I need you the most, kind of a deal. That was the implication of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So the way that I look at all this is that sometimes, like Elijah was prepared for Jezebel to be pursuing him and come after him and everything, he wanted to hear from God, and he got a still, small voice. But that's a Hebrew idiom that the wind just blew by. God didn't speak to him. God wasn't in the still, small voice. He didn't get reassurance from God. And the reason he didn't and was left alone is because God had already prepared him at the sacrifice that he just did miraculously, calling down fire that licked up everything at the altar and melted everything at the altar, even after it was doused with water. So he had that miracle as his foundation to face Jezebel, who he was terrified of and ran away and hid himself from.
Kenny, I don't understand. God.
Yeah.
I don't understand how this settles the issue of God's hiddenness. You know, you can talk about hang on. You can talk about what you think God did for Elijah. I don't have any evidence that there is a God. I don't have any evidence that this story about Elijah is true or that Elijah ever experienced a witness or a miracle or any of those things. But you're reading all of the book and just taking it at face value. So for you, divine hiddenness isn't a big deal. Just like for you, I would imagine that original sin and things aren't a big deal, you know, in the sense of a problem for human beings. So what I'm wondering is this. My argument, or you know, when we're talking about this, when we look at Schellenberg's original argument, that's the name you're thinking of for divine hiddenness.
Thank you very much.
My blood glucose just went through the ceiling, and so I wanted to check it real quick. No, I'm absolutely fine. It beeps on my monitor. So the issue of God's hiddenness has nothing to do with an individual who was prepared otherwise. It is God's hiddenness from everyone and everything all the time. Why, you know, why isn't God, why did you have to call in, Kenny? Why can't God call in? And you said early in the call that when you have issues, God seems to direct you to a book. I would love for you to explain how you know that God has directed you to anything, let alone a book.
Well, because it's the right book that when he directs me to one.
How do you know he directed you to it? The fact that you found a book and it was right doesn't mean that a God directed you to anything. That's what you have to prove. If you're going to say God directs you to a book, you have to show us how you know that he did it.
Well, I'm well aware of the hiddenness of God issue being as universal as you're talking about. My point that I was about to conclude with before you ask your question is simply that God hides himself purposely, and it's in the Bible, and there's reasons why he does it. And so it's not a big mystery that he hides himself. It's how he works.
So what you're saying, Kenny, is you're not going to answer my question. That's what you're saying.
No, I'll answer your question. Okay. Four questions. Okay, you had one question. Let's see, what was it?
How do you
know? Why doesn't God show up?
How did you know that it's God that directed you to a book?
Right. Okay, let's answer that one.
Because I asked God, I need a book because I don't know. And this started in OBU when I had an atheist roommate that was our high school chess champion. Answer all his questions of Christianity. And
Kenny,
so I asked God to show me a book.
Kenny,
from that point on, I got books.
No, Kenny.
And I answered them all and got
I'm sorry, Kenny. But the
Kenny,
fact that you said, the fact that you said, God, direct me to a book, and you found a book, doesn't mean that God directed you to a book any more than you said, God, take away my headache, means that God cured you of your headache.
And so it doesn't matter how the circumstance turned out when the purpose of getting the book was the same.
Correct. You have to show that God did it. If you prayed for God to take away your headache and your headache went away, do you think it's reasonable to conclude that God took away your headache?
Not necessarily, no.
Correct. And the same thing must be true for you asking for a book, right?
If it happens every time I have a headache.
Okay, Kenny. Then this is easy. No. Everybody stop. This is easy. Kenny, listen to me. I want you to go ask God to point you to a book with a specific message that will change my mind. And call me back when God points you to that book. And don't call me back until that happens.
Kenny, can I ask you something?
No, because Kenny's gone.
Oh, shit. I don't understand. I mean, the hit, just so frustrating.
Yeah,
those are frustrating calls.
We hit the 6 o'clock hour, and one of the nice things is that Kenny recognized that, hey, I prayed and my headache went away. That doesn't mean God did it. But Kenny is convinced that, hey, every time I ask God for a book, God gives me a book, or he finds just the right book.
Well, now, maybe it's interesting to me that God can give Kenny a book to read, but he can't save a young girl who's being raped and tortured when she cries out to God, and God remains hidden to her, but yeah. God's going to give Kenny a book he's looking for. Fuck me.
That's why we didn't continue. Kenny needs to ask his God what message he should deliver and what book he should point to. And when that happens, we'll still have to ask.
Book, Matt.
Yeah, we're not going to. But what happens then is that we will still get nowhere. I have one last call I want to try and take real quick. I hope that it's something we can address quickly as we are over time. But Richard in Nevada, we are past time. I apologize. I know you've been waiting a really long time. How can we help?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I do want to talk about what is logically possible versus an illogical concept.
Okay, but logical possibility and illogical concept is not a proper dichotomy. So I don't understand the verses there. So go ahead and tell us what you're pondering, but I think we have a terminology issue.
Okay, thank you. For example, fire cannot logically exist if one of three elements is missing, such as heat, fuel, or oxygen.
No, sir. That's not that has nothing to do with logic. The fact that the fire triangle exists.
Richard,
are you going to let me try and help you here or not?
Go ahead.
Okay. This is about the physical properties of fire. It's not about logical possibility. Okay. So all you're saying, when you say fire can't logically happen if one of the elements of the, that's not a logical thing. That is a science thing. It just happens that you can make a logical argument about it.
Reasoning, sir. Logic is sound reasoning.
I don't know, Richard, because I'm trying. I said we had a terminology issue. Logical possibility has a fairly specific meaning within philosophy and logic. So, okay. Ask your question again using whatever terminology you want, and I'll try and get us there.
Okay, let me give you another illustration. For example, light. The speed of light cannot travel a light year in 6 months. That would be an illogical concept.
Can I stop you here? Because the sentence that you just uttered was the speed of light cannot travel a light year in 6 months. However, the speed of light doesn't travel. It's light that's traveling, and it travels at a particular speed. And that speed is controlled by the medium through which it's traveling. So the speed of light in a vacuum is the speed at which light travels through a vacuum. You are correct that light could not travel in a vacuum the distance that it would normally cover in a year in 6 months. That is correct.
What's the point you're trying to make about logic?
Okay, well, there's a logical concept and there's an illogical concept. And Matt said something about 2 weeks ago, what I really want to comment on. He said, I'm paraphrasing, but Matt said, if evolution were somehow proven false, that would somehow no way prove the existence of God, and that's 100% illogical.
No. That's 100% correct. That is 100% correct, Richard, because if we proved that evolution, the scientific model, evolution by means of natural selection, if we proved that it were wrong, that would not prove that a God exists.
We can't logically exist, so that's an illogical concept.
I'm sorry, Richard, but I'm trying to explain this to you, Richard. And I know you called in because you heard me say something and you want to tell me that it's illogical. But the fact is, my statement is absolutely correct and undeniably so. If you disprove evolution, that does not prove that a God exists.
It does.
No, it doesn't.
How so?
Because
how so,
Richard? Much in the same way that your original statement about logical possibility versus illogical concept is not a true dichotomy, evolution and God is not a true dichotomy. It is a false dilemma. I'm sorry that you don't understand the concept, but it's like saying, let's imagine for a second, this will make sense, Richard. If we proved that the germ theory of disease were wrong, does that mean that diseases are caused by demons?
No, of course not.
Thank you. You just agreed with me because proving evolution wrong, proving the germ theory of disease wrong, neither of those means that you've proved something else is true. It doesn't mean that it proves that demons are responsible for disease, and it doesn't prove that God exists. You have actually just trapped yourself by agreeing with a logically valid in structure argument. You have no way out now.
I consider myself to be a very logical person, and that's the one reason why I brought up the other two points. Is the one thing I can't, I'm like you in the sense, Matt, is I cannot stand stupidity. It drives me crazy.
Richard, you're nothing like Richard. I'm going to mute you because I'm going to say this. You're nothing like me. You say that you can't stand stupidity. What I can't stand is willful ignorance. Stupidity can be fixed. That's what education is. I've spent the bulk of my life sitting here educating people. I just educated you on what a valid and sound argument is by showing you that in the abstract, you agree with the structure that you denied in a different place. Now, if you want to define stupidity as willful ignorance, then yes, you and I are both
Matt, is he trying to say that if we prove evolution is not true, then by default, the creation story is true? Point. Is that what he's
talking about? Oh my gosh, he was talking the whole time he was on mute. I tell you what, Richard, we'll just agree that neither of us can stand stupid, and we'll put me in that category, and you won't have to listen to me anymore. So thanks.
Okay.
Hey, he said okay.
Well, I guess I'm assuming that he was saying that if evolution is proven false, then by default the creation story is true. Is that what he's trying to say?
Yes, he's saying there are only two options: either God made everything or evolution made everything.
And I just can't believe that is a thing he thinks is valid.
Yes,
I mean, and he's using that as, I mean, that's like saying if I found out the man that had been living in our home as my father all these years was not my biological father, then the postman must be. What the hell?
If we prove the butler didn't do it, then clearly it was the maid.
Exactly.
Yeah. He doesn't understand what a true dichotomy is.
You cut him off.
Yeah. And so it's either evolution or not evolution. And out here with all the things that are not evolution, one of the potentials is God, but also it's possible for evolution to be true and for some God to exist that used or worked through evolution as well. So he's wrong. Like, there's this really great concept that everyone should know about, and it's called fractal wrongness. And that means your idea is wrong at every conceivable resolution. Like zooming in on a Mandelbrot set, every time you look at what he says, he's wrong. But
oh, Lord.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you, Dave. And by the way, let's put the crew back up there again, because there was a scramble 30 minutes before we went live to get a hold of me, get me set up in a remote location and be able to do a show. There's the people that make this show happen. Dave, it was a pleasure today. I'm going to get back to enjoying my vacation. But let me remind everybody out there that we are not yet out of a global pandemic. And while the rules and the guidelines from the various health organizations, including the CDC, are changing, we need everybody to do their part. And what I love about the fans and the people that support this program is that we've spent the bulk of the last year learning how to do this show better, and not just from a technical standpoint and doing it remotely, but learning different things about how to address certain arguments, how to interact with people. I'm not always going to get it right. Am I rude? Yeah, sometimes. Am I an asshole? Sure, on occasion. Do I think it's justified? Yeah, most of the time, but I'm going to be wrong on occasion. And so is Dave, and so is Jenna, and so is Shannon, but don't tell her I said so, and so is Jim. And so is everyone that's involved in this content. I just posted a video on my personal Atheist Debates project where I offered a correction to a caller who had called in who said, hey, the Bible says that the Garden of Eden is in Mesopotamia. And I said, no, it doesn't. And plus the Mormons think it's in Missouri. There's more details in the correction video. Clearly, I know that Genesis talks about the Tigris and Euphrates. And so that would place Mesopotamia as one of the potential locations for the Garden of Eden. But somebody wrote in and was just outraged. And you owe your fans a correction, and you owe that caller an apology. And I don't completely agree with that because of what was in my head about what I was trying to say. The location of the Garden of Eden isn't specified, and it wasn't relevant to the point she was trying to make. But in the spirit of that, I hereby offer an unreserved apology to the caller, provided that she felt that I was denying what she meant, that said the Tigris and Euphrates. And if that's the way the conversation went, then I hereby apologize without reservation. And I would let everyone else know that while we don't know the location of the Garden of Eden, it does list it at a sort of junction of four rivers, including two that are identified as the Tigris and Euphrates. And so that now the next question for people to ask is, why haven't we found it? I mean, we've got Google Maps. We've got satellite pictures of the Earth. We can scour everything. I mean, if the Garden of Eden is still on Earth and it's being protected by cherubim at one side and a flaming sword that points in all directions at the other side, surely we should be able to see that. Let's get some expeditions launched in that area to see if we can't find the Garden of Eden.
Matt, it's in a third dimension. You know that. Come on.
Hey, I know what my pastor told me, which is that it was removed from the earth to keep men from getting to it. And my response to that was, if it's somewhere we can't get to, why does it need to be guarded by a flaming sword?
We found Noah's Ark in Turkey, so we
don't
find a garden.
Okay, before anybody emails to say we need to correct that, Dave is wrong. We have not actually found Noah's Ark.
I'm kidding.
I love doing this show. I love doing it with Dave, man. And everybody else. Please take care of yourself. And remember, don't just believe something because we said it. Even though, you know, caller was wrong about a logical argument, go out and do some research yourself. But mostly, go out and enjoy your life with other people and exercise precautions because we want to see you all back next week when I'm back in Austin. Thank you, guys. Take care.
See you, guys. Bye-bye.